The following episode journeys into the Hyborian Age, a savage world of steel and sorcery where kingdoms rose and crumbled beneath the weight of their own impossible names. From Zamora to Zamboula, from Kitai to Corinthia, every land bears a title that mocks the limits of mortal pronunciation. In other words, folks, you're going to hear a great big bunch of names that I will certainly butcher as ruthlessly as Conan cleaves his enemies in twain. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast that's treading the jeweled thrones of Hyboria beneath its sneakered feet, one comic book at a time. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and today we return to Agrippur and finally meet the king, because I'm going to be looking at Conan the Barbarian number 36 from Marvel Comics. This issue sports a cover date of March 1974, though it hit the stands in December of 1973. It sold for just 20 cents, and it is entitled Beware the Hyrcanians Bearing Gifts. It was written by Roy Thomas, with pencils by John Buscema, inks by Ernie Chan, the letters were by Artie Simic, and the colorist was Glynis Ween.
Into the boat!
Following the events of the previous issue, Conan gallops into Agrippur like a thunderclap.
Let's ride!
Exhausted from the ride, his horse collapses and dies. But the Cimmerian is a ragged spear of determination. All to drop the dangerous truth of Juan Tangri at the feet of Naram Bey and his king. Duty, it seems, suits Conan. So does royal favor, as King Yildiz, impressed by the Cimmerian's stamina and blunt usefulness, plucks Conan from the ranks and crowns him, in practice, if not by title, a member of his personal guard. Conan's reward for obedience is a bed in the palace, and more unexpectedly, the amorous attentions of the erotically agile Amytis, Naram Bey's voluptuous concubine, a soft, dangerous thing who binds the barbarian's wounds in silks while the rest of the court looks on and whispers. Now don't worry, his palace life doesn't turn Conan soft. He slugs insults down with a scowl and then trains, like for weeks, months even, trains like a man possessed, learning all about horses and bows and spears and axes and the awkward, elegant dances of court weapons that are definitely not the Cimmerian stock and trade. Conan becomes the joke made inconveniently true, that the wild Cimmerian can be taught the manners of kings and the arts of arms without losing an ounce of murderous efficiency. But while Conan polishes his blade and his horseback posture, the kingdom receives an ostentatious gift from Yildiz's conquering son, Yezdegerd. It's a huge, headless statue rolled in like a grim monument from the Hyrcanian Wars. Yildiz admires the gesture. Conan, well, Conan doesn't quite trust anything but his own sword arm. Sure enough, though, later, when the priest of Demors arrives with the statue's missing head and places it upon the thing's shoulders, the stone colossus comes to life. Stone becomes motion. Stone becomes slaughter. What was meant to be tribute turns into terror as the golem tears through the hall, crushing nobles and disrupting the court's delicate composure. Conan, newly drilled in all manner of weapons and quick with a thrown axe, studies the carnage and sees the puppet strings. The priest is no holy man, but a mouthpiece. The golem obeys him. Timing being everything, Conan throws the axe and it makes contact with the priest's throat. This severs the magical bond and the monster collapses like a two-ton rag doll. King Yildiz stares at the ruin and the seeds of doubt begin to take root. Was this a trap from Yezdegerd, a ploy by ambitious courtiers, or a demonstration that the throne is a brittle thing, easy to topple with a stone in a sorcerer's hand? Again, folks, I'm going to let you be the judge of that. As the issue ends, Naram Bey, who has been watching Amytis and Conan closely and with suspicion in his eyes, makes a request of the king. He has need for one such as Conan for a dangerous mission, And the king, in his weariness over the day's adventure, agrees, releasing Conan back into Narambe's charge. All right, so according to Roy Thomas, in his book, Barbarian Life, a literary biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, this is the first Conan story since issue 31 that was not adapted from a story written by Robert E. Howard or L. Sprague de Camp or Lynn Carter or even Norval W. Page. Heck, even Robert Jordan, for that matter. I don't know how old Robert Jordan was at the time. But anyway, this story in this issue was all Roy. The story's title, Beware the Hyrcanians Bearing Gifts, it comes from a quote that I don't know if it's a factual quote. I don't know if it was chiseled into stone, but apparently it stretches back to the Trojan Wars. And the quote is, beware Greeks bearing gifts. And it, of course, pertains to the infamous, you know, big hollow wooden Trojan horse that had people inside it. Anyway, it's a quote that I guess Roy thinks is pretty neat. And so he used it for this here Conan tale. He also, in his book, clears up a little something that, for me at least, was, I was getting confused. I was starting to get a bit confused. And it's about the Turanians and the Hyrcanians. And you know what? Since I had so much fun pretending to be Roy in the last episode, I wanted to do that again in this episode. So yeah, I'm just going to read this straight from the book as if I was Roy, or as if I was somebody pretending to be Roy Thomas who's never heard Roy Thomas talk and has really no idea what Roy Thomas really sounds like. Here we go.
A word about that word, Hyrcanians. Since the empire-expanding denizens of Turin were of Hyrcanian descent, Robert E. Howard often refers to Turanians as Hyrcanians in the original stories. I decided that that would be confusing to our readers, so I rarely referred to Turanians as Hyrcanians. The Hyrcanians may have been the same racial stock as the Turanians, but there was a deep hatred between the two, since Turin was trying, in the comics at least, to conquer Hyrcanian territory on the eastern coast of the Viliate Sea. In Howard's stories, Turin was also expansionist. He just never got as specific about it. There was no country in the Hyborian Age actually called Hyrcania, by the way. Only a series of city-states with people of common descent, but no unity, and thus ripe for the picking by the highly organized and aggressive Turanians.
Thank you, Roy. Wink, wink. that's so stupid. So this issue marks the first appearance of King Yildiz. We've heard his name a few times, of course, but this is the first time we're actually seeing him in the flesh. And he's not really all that physically imposing, not in any way. And I mean, he looks like the sort of king who probably inherited his throne from his father. And so he spent his entire life not having to do stuff for himself and never having to fight or struggle for anything that he needed. It was just all given to him. And now that I've seen him, now that I've can put a face, put a body to the name, it makes sense that Yezdegerd, the prince, that he's the one out there expanding the empire rather than the king. Because I don't think the king has a lot of experience in fighting. He might be well trained. He might have had a lot of practice. He might have been trained in the art of various weapons, but he probably hasn't had any real life experience as far as fighting an actual person who wants to cut his head off. So that makes sense that Yezdegerd's the one out there doing it. We also get the return of Narambe and Lady Amatis in the issue. Both of them first appeared in Conan the Barbarian number 32, Flame Winds of Lost Kitai. Narambe, if you recall, is a garrison commander in the Turanian army, and he's the guy who sent Conan to Wan Tangri back in issue 32. He does so by first inviting Conan to his crib for a bit of dinner, and that's when Conan and us, the reader, that's when we meet Lady Amatis, who, according to MarvelFandom.com, was Narambe's hot-blooded paramour. Normally, I just not try to read stuff like that directly off of a website, but hot-blooded paramour. For some reason, I can picture Hank Hill from King of the Hill saying it. Hot-blooded paramour. I don't do a very good Hank impression. Anyway, it's too good. It's too good not to say. Anyway, let's dive into the issue, shall we? right, so the cover to this issue was penciled by John Romita, and it was inked by Ernie Chan, and I think that kind of explains why it's not one of my favorites. It's basically, you've got the stone statue thing on the front of it. It's holding in one of its mighty stone hands, Lady Amethyst, and then Conan is swinging at it with an axe. He's hitting the thing in the chest with his axe. The axe is exploding. There are dead people all around, and it's not that bad. I'm just not a big fan of John Romita. I'm not a big fan of his art. I don't know what it is, because I'm looking at it, and if I look at various bits, if I'm like looking at Conan just by himself, he looks pretty awesome. If I'm looking at Amethyst all by herself, she looks damn good. If I look at the stone statue by itself, it looks pretty good. I put them all together, I don't care for it. Maybe it's the red, orange, yellow sky thing that's going on in the background. Sometimes I have a real problem with colors on a cover that just could ruin what would be a perfectly great looking cover. You know, maybe if I had seen this first, just in pencils and inks, I would be thinking it's a pretty kick-ass cover, but it doesn't really do a lot for me. Though that Conan on the front, that's a good looking Conan. And he's got an axe. What did I just say in the last episode? That was serendipitous, wasn't it? Wink, wink. That I've been hoping to see Conan use an axe. And he's using an axe in this one. And he's using it right there on the front cover. We also get a little blurb thing there at the bottom, a little title headline teaser that says, The Fury of the Stone God. Get into the issue. We get the title page right up there at top. Beware the Hyrcanians bearing gifts. We are told who worked on the issue, of course, and it does say up here, based on the hero created by Robert E. Howard. So yeah, I think I mentioned it in the last issue, because the way they had put it up there in the last issue, because that story was based off of a Robert E. Howard story, but it wasn't a Conan story. Anyway, I found it amusing the way they put it in the last issue, and I was thinking, using my memory thing, I was thinking they mentioned it in every issue that they had to put up there that it's based on Robert E. Howard, but I mean, that just makes sense, right? Anyway, Conan, this opening page here is a splash page, and it features Conan on a horse, and he is riding full tilt through a street in some city.
Let's ride!
People are jumping out of his way. The hooves of the horse are churning up the ground, shit's flying everywhere. People are diving under benches and vases and pots and stuff, because it's obviously a market street. That stuff's falling over and breaking and crashing. Conan looks like shit. He's just got crap all over him. And what the hell's going on, right?
What the hell is going on?
We get a little bit of narration here.
Picture yourself a peasant in the lusty, roaring Hyborian age of 12,000 years ago. Your lot, we fear, is hardly a happy one. For at any moment, the stagnant tranquility of your squalid life is liable to be interrupted by parading guardsmen, arrogant nobles, or even a wild-eyed, haggard-looking barbarian tearing madly through mud-laden streets on a mission you cannot, will never know.
Turn the page. We get a bit more narration.
He's seen sights you'll never see. Wizards in seven colors and flame winds and demons that stride the dark temples of the desert. Yes, he's seen them all and more, and they have taken their toll.
So yeah, Conan has ridden into town. He looks like shit. He's covered in shit. He looks tired. He's sweating. The horse doesn't look like it's in... I mean, you can't really... I'll be honest with you. You look at the horse and your first thought isn't, well, that horse is in bad shape. It looks like a horse. But you consider the way Conan looks. You consider this mad, chaotic rush into the city. You consider the fact that both of them, both Conan and the horse, are just covered in muck and grime. And if Conan himself is sweating and he looks exhausted, that horse is probably on its last legs. Conan, at the top of page two, you get him in these two panels, and that second panel, it's a great panel. It's one of those John Buscema panels that you just love. It's just a panel of Conan on the horse riding through the street. But what John Buscema has decided to do, because the first panel on the page is also Conan on the horse riding through the street. So, you know, as an artist, you can't just try to interpret exactly what's in the script or whatnot. You've got to become the director You've got to become the director of photography. You've got to become the director of photography. You've got to know where to put the camera, right? You don't want it to be boring. You don't want to be the same static image for the entire issue. And so in this first panel, it's a close-up of Conan. You don't see the horse at all. You can see one of his hands holding the reins, and it's kind of at an angle. And he looks, like I said, he looks tired. But then that second panel, still Conan on the horse riding through the street. But what he's done is he's put the camera inside of a building next to the street, and we're looking through the window. We can see people where at whatever this building is. I'm assuming it's a pub or a whatever they would call it in Turin. Because there's three guys at least in there. You see the backs of their heads. They're looking out the window, and Conan is riding by. He even put a guy on the background cringing as Conan's riding by. He's got water in the street with water splashing up from the hooves, and he didn't need to do all that. And it just makes it more interesting to have not just different shots. You know, if you're going to have a scene that's just a guy riding through the main street of a city, you know, you're going to have to shoot it at different angles so it's not boring. But I like this. Just this idea of putting us inside this shop or this cantina or whatever, and seeing Conan ride by. It makes you feel more like you're not reading this on Conan's side. I guess you're a member of. You know, you're a citizen of this city, and this is just, you're just hanging out, and suddenly this half-naked barbarian, filthy, mud-caked, sweating, exhausted barbarian just comes riding this horse in like a freaking mad horse, and I'm assuming there's foam on its sides or whatever, because that's usually what happens when a horse is ready to pass out and die. But we go from there, we're still on page two, and we meet the king, King Yildiz. He is standing there in the middle of this panel. This is the second panel on page two. It's the middle of the page, one long panel that takes up the center of the page. The king is standing there with Naram Bey to one side, who's introducing him to his best men to be used as part of the palace guard. And he's explaining to the king that there is best men, but there is best men that he has available, because really his best men are with the prince out expanding the empire. But these guys will do. On the side where Naram Bey, so like I said, the king's in the center. You've got Naram Bey on one side of him, and then you've got these five guardsmen on the other side of him. The side where Naram Bey is, we see Lady Amatis, and then there's some other dude back there with her. But the king, not only is he a little portly, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a little portly. He's also not very tall. There's nothing wrong with that either. But He looks like a grocer. We'll put it that way. He's got more. What's the Hobbit line? He's got more of a grocer in him than burgling. I don't know, but
he looks more like a grocer than a burglar.
he's dressed regally. He's got a crown on his head, but he's just. You look at all the other people on this page, and he's the one that stands out the most because he's wearing red, while everybody else is wearing gray of some sort. Except for Lady Amatis has a red cape on, but she's more in the background. And the fact that he's in the center. So even with the page in general, he is who your eyes are drawn to first, because he's dead in the center. He's probably the splashiest bit of color on the page, but physically he's not very impressive. And like I said, you're immediately given the impression that if he did, you know, if he's the one who fought for this throne, if he gained the throne through violence and he fought for it every inch of the way and he bled and, you know, killed and lost friends, he's obviously had the throne for a long time and he's gone quite soft. Otherwise, my first impression, like I said, was that he probably inherited the throne from his father and he's just grown up as a very soft, soft person, not doing anything for themselves. And then that would make sense. Typically, kids tend to rebel against their parents. And so that makes Yildiz more of an ass kicker getting out there and trying to expand the empire.
All these royal types are inbreeding, wall-eyed, buck-toothed monsters who have to be wheeled around under a blanket.
So we learn here that this other guy, as Yildiz is looking over these troops that Narambay have you know, that he's brought to him. We learn that this other guy that's kind of hanging back with the Lady Amatus, his name is Fayed Rotha. And he reminds me a bit of Fafnir, the Asgardian Three, the Warriors Three in the Marvel books.
Actually, the name Stephen meant to use was Fandral, who is a member of the Warriors Three, who, according to Wikipedia, are a group of fictional characters appearing in American comic books published by Marvel Comics, and they are the Asgardians Fandral, Hogan, and Volstagg.
He looks a bit foppish. He looks a bit, you know, like a Errol Flynn type of rogue, you know, like a dandy rogue type of guy. He's got his thin mustache that stretches out to either side. He's got his perfectly coiffed, feathered hair, big pirate-like boots that everybody wears in a Marvel comic. I love them. Captain America boots, I've always called them, but they're basically pirate boots. Yeah, his name is Fayed Rotha, and he has some kind of relationship with Lady Amatus, not a romantic one, but he points out to her that Narambay, and he's the one that refers to Narambay as her paramour, so obviously that's why they put it in that MarvelFandom.com entry, but still, they added hot-blooded, which is great, but he's pointing out to her that the king doesn't seem to be heaping much glory on her paramour this day, and she doesn't want to hear it. She tells him to hold his tongue, which, no, that's not fun. But in the end, by the end of the page, the king, these guys aren't much, but, you know, what choice do we have? I guess they'll be fine. But as he's making that decision, he mentions that while these guys will do, he wishes he could have, like, one guy, one big, dependable, ass-kicking dude who can just be there with him at all times, especially when he's on his royal walking tours. And Narambay tells him he's got somebody in mind. We turn the page. Narambay, whose uniform has gone from a purplish gray in the previous page to those are other guards. There's some other guards that now have arrived, and they've got bright blue uniforms on with yellow capes, yellow stripes going down the middle. But Narambay is explaining to the king that he turned the page, we're on page three, and he's telling the king that he's already got somebody in mind, a giant of a man, a barbarian from half-fabled Sumeria. So people here have heard of Sumeria, but not everybody even believes that it really truly exists. So it's half-fabled. And Narambay is telling him that he has recently sent this man off on a mission, and he should be returning. And as he's saying this, we get these three panels where we're looking at basically one of these guardsmen. He's in the foreground on the left hand, taking up the left half of the panel. And it's just him from the knees down. So we get his knees and his feet. And then on the other half of the panel, the right hand side in the corner, the bottom right hand corner, very small on that first panel, we see the silhouette of what appears to be somebody riding a horse. And we can see dust being kicked up behind the horse. Second panel is a bit of the same. The guy on the horse is a bit closer, and the guardsman now, his knees are bent as if he is starting to notice that somebody is riding up, which he probably has noticed because I'm sure he can hear the hooves. They're outside, and Conan's not that far away, but he's starting to turn. It looks like the guy's starting to turn. And then in the third panel, Conan's practically on top of him. The guardsman has turned completely around, and it looks like he's leaping out of the way, and he's yelling, "Demons of Urlik!" And I keep meaning to look up who Urlik is, but I haven't. But I'll do that at some point.
I gotta stop procrastinating.
So Conan just comes storming in, still on his horse. He rides right in the middle of everybody, practically knocks the king on his ass, and rides the horse to it, you know, and basically the horse just collapses. Just rides until it falls. And Conan pulls himself up off the horse. Horse is dead. Narambay is pushing the king out of the way, yelling that it's a madman! A madman!
You are a madman!
He actually only says madman once, but Conan gets up and it's like, nah, man, I'm no madman. It's me. It's me. It's Conan. Remember? You sent me to Kitai? I've got your report. And there's this great moment because Naram Bey doesn't care. He's pissed. And he says to him,
"Dog, you nearly killed your king."
And Conan's response,
"Your king, not mine. I just work here."
And then the very next thing he says is,
"Now shut up. I've got a report to give. Blast you both. And by Crom, I'm gonna..."
And he passes out. We get a couple of pages of ads. Pages 4 and 5 are ads. We go to page 6. And there's a bit of, there's a curious panel layout here. I've seen this done every now and again, especially with these, the comics from this generation, this era. Because typically you're supposed to read a comic the way you read, or an American comic, the way you read an American book, left to right, top to bottom. And the panels should, if the artist knows what they're doing, if they're a good artist and they're a good panelologist, they will, you know, they're in the game of visual storytelling. And so they have to lay out that page so that you can read it left to right, top to bottom. And it makes sense. Your eye will naturally go from panel to panel the way the story is supposed to be read. But sometimes, and I don't know what causes this, I'd really like to know if you're an artist working in the game, especially if you're an artist from back then and you're listening to this, help me understand how this happens. Because the way that this the panels are laid out here on page 6, they're not crazy, but somebody, I'm assuming it was Buscema, but somebody felt the need to add arrows between some of the panels so that you know which panel to go to next. It's like panel 1 to panel 2 is left to right. Panel 2 is on the right side of the page. It extends down so that the bottom of panel 2 is, well, nothing is overlapping each other, but it's if panel 3, which is on the left hand of the page, if it extended the length of the page, then panel 2 on the right side would cover up the top half corner. I'll just put it that way. Anyway, yeah, there's an arrow leading from panel 2 to panel 3, an arrow leading from panel 3 to panel 4, and an arrow leading from panel 4 to panel 5. So it's kind of like a Z, the way those panels fall into line. And I don't know. I don't know if this is like the artist is laying out the page and they get done and they kind of look at it and go, "Well, shit, that's not, I fucked that up. Somebody might find that confusing. I better add these arrows." I don't know. I don't know what, especially when we're talking about a Marvel comic book in this age, because they're still working using the Marvel method. John Buscema's not given a script. If anything, if he's given anything on paper, it's a very basic plot of the story. This is what's going to happen. Here's some things we might want to hit, you know? And then it's up to John Buscema to actually tell the story with his art. And then Roy would come in and add all the words and such. He would write, finalize the dialogue and all that based on John Buscema's art. So the fact that the arrows are put there make me feel like under the right circumstances, this is not the way they would have set this page up. This is not how they would have laid these panels out. So I'm curious how that happens.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
Hello, how are you? This is Sean Merrick from the podcast Worst Collection Ever, where myself and my wife, Jennifer Stansfield Merrick, talk about the weird, the funny, and absolutely insane comic books in our comic book collection. Are they good? Probably not, but we're going to have fun anyways. We took a little break, but now we're back with brand new episodes, so please check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, even check us out on YouTube, Angry Hero 79. You can subscribe, you can review, you can rate on there, and we'd love to hear from you. So check you then.
Worlds would live.
Worlds would die.
And DC Comics would never be the same again.
Crisis and Infinite Earths, the crossover so epic it reached every corner of the DC multiverse. Join DC Dave
and Doug Adamson as we discuss The Monitor Tapes,
a Crisis in Infinite Earths podcast.
Find us on your favorite podcatcher and join the discussion at themonitortapes.com.
Love her, love Uncle Ben. They are the best. just ask the whole group of kids, hey, do y'all want to go to the science exhibit? Like it's the most normal thing in the world. I felt this bite on my hand. It was a weird looking spider, like it was glowing. This is amazing. So before it fades, I've got to figure out something I can do. Okay, world, better hang on to your hat. Here comes the Spider-Man. The Spider Diaries, a John Reed's Comics production. Look for the Spider Diaries on your favorite podcatcher or at johnreedscomics.com, and there's no H in John.
And now back to Hither Came Conan.
Just curious, if anybody knows, let me know. But on this page, we have Narambe now, who's apologizing to the king for Conan, who basically at this point is a common soldier. Not only a common soldier, he's not even Turanian. He's an outlander. He's a dirty barbarian. And he's like, I mean, yeah, this is the guy I would have put in charge of keeping you safe. But after today, I'm rethinking that. And the king does what we see this often in these types of stories, where you're just going to assume, yeah, there's no way the king is going to allow somebody like Conan around them because Conan's a dirty barbarian. He's uncouth. He has no manners. He's rude. He's a barbarian. That meant something more than a warrior class in Dungeons and Dragons. And this king, though, he's a groovy king. He's the teacher that's got long hair that doesn't do grades and wants everybody to call him by his first name, plays guitar, brings out his acoustic, plays guitar during class. Because this is the King Yildiz, his response. Well, first, Narambe tells him,
a thousand pardons, sire, that a common soldier, an outlander to boot, should speak thus to the chosen of Tareem. Rest assured his tongue will be sliced so that he'll never again...
And King Yildiz interrupts him.
Nonsense! True enough, the man is a lout, with the manners of a Kushian river horse. Still, it is such a man who is stopped by nothing and no one. That I must have as my personal guard. See that he reports to the palace after he's cleaned up, of course.
And so, yeah, this is one of these groovy kings. He's a thinker. He's like, yeah, he's a dirty, filthy barbarian. Probably scratches his armpits in front of anybody. Picks his nose, scratches his butt. But this is the guy. This is the only kind of person that's going to keep me safe. So I'm willing to put up with it. But I'm only going to put up with it for so far. We get that a little bit later. We get a little bit here between that Fayed Rotha and Lady Amatis. He's whispering to her. He was whispering to her. They were whispering to each other in the previous page as well. But I'm assuming we're going to see more of this guy. There is a part in Roy's book in the chapter where he's talking about this issue that the name of this character, I think he got from something else. There were maybe even a trio of characters from another story that he took all three of these names from, Narambe, Fayed Rotha, and Amatis. In fact, I think Narambe, the character that he took that name from was Naram something other, and Roy changed it because he felt it didn't sound Turanian. But he does mention that they will become a bigger part of the story, or they will have a bigger role to play a little later down the line. But initial thoughts, Fayed Rotha is a shit-stirring dick. And he starts whispering to Lady Amatis here that,
well, well, sweet Amatis, I do believe I saw your star-bestrewn eyes light up when that mud-caked savage rode lickety-split onto the scene. Your ecstatic joy, no doubt, of seeing one of your beloved's missions carried out.
So he's like, I saw you get pretty excited when that big strapping hunk of beef rode in. Maybe you're just excited because your paramour's mission has been completed. You're excited for him. It has nothing to do with the half-naked, rugged, sexy barbarian. And she tells him basically, that's your last warning. I'm not going to tell you again. And then she turns to the guardsmen and tells them to take Conan to her quarters where she will tend to him. And she's giving him a lot of shit because they're picking him up and she's telling him that he's not a sack of flour. He's a human being.
He works for her husband.
Did you know who my husband is? He's near in bay.
Except he's not her husband. He's her paramour. Her lover in the nighttime, as they would put it on psych.
We're partners in a detective agency.
Oh.
But we're also lovers in the nighttime. Will you stop it?
So Conan is taken to her place. Narambe comes to see Amethyst real quick because he's got to leave. He's going to tour the troops at Akif, and he will return in a few, but she interrupts him. We don't find out how long he's going to be gone. She gives him kind of an over-the-shoulder response, kind of an afterthought, and then she starts yelling at the guardsmen who are carrying Conan.
And now, my darling, I must leave you for a tour of the troops at Akif. But I shall return in a few...
My heart goes with you, dearest Narambe, as ever.
Easy with him, I say! It's his horse that's dead!
That's great. She's very obvious here that she cares more about Conan than her paramour, her lover, her booty call. And you think it would be fairly obvious to Narambe at this point as well. And I think it kind of is. But as we come to the bottom of the page, Conan is now in Amethyst's room, her quarters. He's laying on a big, giant pillow, and there are three half-naked ladies tending to his wounds.
Sexy, sexy.
And there's... I'm really not trying to read just everything from these issues, but every once in a while, when I think, okay, I'm not going to read anymore, then I run across something that's like, all right, this bit of narration needs to be shared because I love it. Because this bottom panel, it's one long, wide panel here at the bottom of page 6, we get that bit... The panel right before this is the one where Amethyst is yelling at the guardsmen that it's his horse that's dead. So in other words, stop treating him like he's dead. He's a wounded person. And so then the narration, we get to the next panel, it says,
as for what happens to the remains of Conan's late and unlamented mount, perhaps that is better left unsaid, especially to those who man the barracks at Akif.
Sounds like no soldiers are going to be eating horse meat tonight.
They didn't care about that back then is the thing. Back then. It's not a real place. This isn't real history, folks. What am I talking about? Turn the page. Conan is coming to. He's coming out of his unconscious state. And as he's becoming aware of his surroundings, he can feel somebody's touching him. That's the three half-naked ladies who are tending to his wounds. But to Conan, a Sumerian, a barbarian born in blood, he considers that what he's feeling is something else. He doesn't immediately go, all right, the ladies are touching me. He immediately assumes that he is either somebody's trying to steal from him or somebody's trying to hurt him in some fashion, kill him or whatever. And so he immediately bounds to life. He springs up. He grabs one of the ladies by the arm and he yells out,
enemies away, you hounds of Hyboria. I'll Crom, who the devil?
And that's when Lady Amethyst comes in and she explains to Conan what's going on. Conan is still pretty groggy. She asks him how he's... She dismisses basically the her maids, or I don't know if they tell us who these ladies are, and they don't. I'm not seeing them. Anyway, I'm assuming they're maids. She dismisses him, asks how Conan is doing. He's still got quite a headache. He's still kind of groggy. So he lays back. She gets down there with him on the big giant pillow, and she's got a wet rag, and she's wiping off his muscly chest. And then, oh, I'm so groggy, and... Ooh, you're touching my chest. And then he realizes, oh, wait, I've got a report. I have this report. That's why my horse died. I got a report to Narambe. And she explains to him that Narambe's gone and he's going to be gone for a fortnight. Once she is down there on the cushions with him, once she's rubbing his chest with her moist rag, and once she informs him that her paramour is gone for a fortnight, well, things start happening. Turn the page, and the two are getting it on. And in fact, it's actually Conan that instigates it. She seems, I mean, I don't want to be one of those guys like she's asking for it, but the way she's written, by a man, by the way, I'll just point that out. The way she is written, she's being written so that it is clear to everyone involved that she wants it. But again, it was written by a man. So Conan basically, he's like, so your lover boy's gone for a few weeks, eh? Well then, and then he grabs her and starts kissing her. He throws her onto her back. He's looming over her, and she says,
you're a fool, Conan. Narambe ever learns of this.
And he interrupts her.
Who will tell him? You? Whose eyes seared mine when we first met.
Not likely.
They do it. We're assuming they can't, of course, show that in any comic with a Comics Code Authority stamped thing there on the cover. But it's one of those, you know, it's like one of those TV shows. They start making out. They start kissing. There's probably gross, wet, slobbery sounds. We see the serving wenches, as Conan calls them. They're in the other room, but there's really nothing separating. I mean, there's walls, but there are great big open doorways separating where they're at and where Conan and Amytus is. I don't know why I'm having such trouble trying to figure out how to say that. But they look at each other and they put their fingers up to their lips like, shh. And then they close the big doors and they leave Conan and Amytus alone. And then we have a panel of the two of them like sinking into the mattress, the blazing sun setting behind them. And if there were audio to accompany this comic book, if it was one of those fancy, you know, it's a fancy comic book that had music to play, we'd be hearing a saxophone. The next page, page 11, it's at least the next day, the next morning. Conan is out training with a bow. He has mentioned before that he considers the bow and arrow an unmanly weapon. But at the same time, Conan's not stupid. He's traveling the world. He's starting to understand that he should probably learn how to use a bow and arrow. He should probably learn how to use maybe some other weapons other than just a sword and a knife and his brute strength. And so he starts to practice with this bow and arrow. There are two, I guess there are fellow soldiers watching Conan. One of them is unnamed. He's wearing like the turban with the helmet and the whole uniform, really. The other guy is bald. He's got the long pointy mustache. He's wearing a vest and big puffy pants. And his name is Swartho. Swartho. They don't name the other guy, but we get the name Swartho. And I keep meaning to look up. Just going to do that real quick.
According to MarvelFandom.com, Swartho was one of King Yildiz' personal guards, who was knocked down by Conan when he mocked his scarce archery skill.
Alas, this does appear to be Swartho's only appearance. He doesn't die. That's the only reason I check. Usually if we see somebody like this, because he's a big guy. It's a big, bald, muscly guy. I don't know what Roy has against bald people, or maybe John Buscema, since he's the one that's drawn the thing. Seems like Conan goes up against a lot of just big, bald guys.
What do you think I mean, bald? Bald! Bald, bald!
But Swartho is a great big, bald guy, and they do have an encounter, but Swartho survives, which is the only reason I looked up to see if he shows up again. That's a shame. Shame they never used a character named Swartho again. Jim Zub, if you're listening, I expect Swartho to show up in a future Titan Conan book. Make it happen, Captain. Make it happen, Captain.
Sorry, that was unnecessary.
So anyway, this unnamed soldier and Swartho, they start mocking Conan as he's practicing with the bow and arrow. Conan takes a shot, basically, at a target, like a straw torso, basically, an armless torso with a head. Made a burlap and straw that's on a big stick. He's firing arrows at it, and it looks like he hit it once, way, way in the top of the head. Like it's basically, it just went through the seam at the very top and it stuck there. But otherwise, he's been missing the dummy, and he gets frustrated, and he goes,
"The bow's an unmanly weapon anyway."
And that's when the two start mocking him.
Unmanly? Now, what would an uncouth barbarian know about manliness, Swartho?
Aye, brother. I've had two wives could bend a bow to better purpose than that.
So this scene, actually, based on what Roy has to say about it in the chapter of his book, Barbarian Life, a Literary Biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, I feel like this scene was put in this book primarily because there was a quote from Robert E. Howard. It comes out of The Tower of the Elephant, and it was a quote that, because we've already had Tower of the Elephant, it was issue 4. And he wasn't able to fit this quote into issue 4. It didn't make sense, I guess, for it to show up in the story that the quote comes from. So he puts it here, but it's not a quote, like it's not something that somebody says. It's just something that Robert E. Howard had written in the Tower of the Elephant, one of his observations on civilized society that he used as the kind of the basis of Conan and, you know, the difference between Conan being a barbarian and being among civilians who are supposed to be civilized but seem much more barbaric than him. But the quote says, "Civilized men are more discourteous than savages because they know they can be impolite without having their skulls split as a general thing." And so apparently Roy liked that quote. It's not a bad quote, but because he couldn't figure out a way to have it be part of his adaptation of Tower of the Elephant, couldn't put it in there without any way of, I don't know. He doesn't really explain that bit. What he says is,
"A courtyard scene in number 36 in which two Turanians insult Conan and pay the consequences gave me a chance to use one of my favorite phrases from Robert E. Howard's story, Tower of the Elephant, which I hadn't slipped into Conan number 4 because it was only a bit of narration, not a line of dialogue."
So, I don't know. I don't know what that means. Maybe, I don't know. I can only assume that what Roy means by that is when he is adapting one of Robert E. Howard's stories, or I guess one of the pastiches as well, if it's dialogue, he will take it directly from the original source and use the dialogue as written. In most cases, I guess, I don't know. But when it comes to narration, I guess he prefers to write his own narration. That's the only thing I can think of what he actually means by that. But yeah, so this scene, Conan is practicing the bow. He's not doing very well. He's getting upset. Some dude and his buddy Swartho gives him shit about it. And Conan basically walks up to the two of them and bonks their heads together. One page. And it's really kind of there for that quote. "Civilized men are more discourteous than savages because they know they can be impolite without having their skulls split as a general thing," which, I don't know, I guess I would interpret that to say that normally in a polite society, you can be an asshole to somebody without worry of them taking a swing at you. But then to add as a general thing means, but that doesn't mean that it's, you're going to get that lucky every time. Somebody's going to take a swing at you. Can't be an asshole and not face any consequences. But these guys assume that they can mock Conan and make fun of him and laugh at him, and Conan's not going to do jack shit because they live in a society. They got rules. They're soldiers. They can't fight amongst themselves. Instead, Conan walks up to the two of them, grabs them both by the head, each head, one hand on either side. You know what I'm saying? You know what it looks like when you bonk two heads together. But he tells him as he's doing it,
"In Cimmeria, we chain our dogs outside the gates so they don't befoul our houses."
Snap. Snappy. I mean, it's not the greatest comeback. It's not the greatest insult, but, you punctuate it with conking two guys' heads together means a bit more. But of course, he leaves them there on the ground, laying together unconscious. He tries the bow again, misses, and then he throws it down in frustration. That's the moment that the king decides to arrive upon the scene. We're on page 14. King shows up. He's super pumped. He's super happy because it's the day that Naram Bey has returned to the palace. And since he was supposed to be gone for a fortnight, so that means it's been 2 weeks since Naram Bey left. And why is the king so happy that Naram Bey is back? It's not because he's super happy to see Naram Bey. It's not like he's, you know, Naram Bey's his best bud or maybe they're lovers behind doors. None of that. He's not happy to see Naram Bey. That's not what excites him. But he knows that Naram Bey is bringing him presents, and he's really happy about that. And what he's brought him, we see it here at the end of this page, page 14, is a big statue without a head. And so the king, who is, he's got Lady Amethyst with him. So I'm just going to read you this conversation that happens here between Conan and the king, starting with Conan throwing down the bow and leading to, well, I'm going to read quite a bit here. Conan's practicing with the bow. Misses, throws it down.
"Unmanly, I say, unmanly! Ho, Outlander! Why the long face? It's a morning for rejoicing! And I've chosen you and our just-returned hero, Naram Bey, to share it with me. He and his lady. You do know the Lady Amethyst, do you not?"
"We've met."
"Splendid, splendid! Then we're all good friends here. And good friends, even if some are but soldiers and others monarchs, should share good news. Good news, Blessed of Tirim?" "Aye,
this. The stone statue, Majesty, weighs many a pound, true, but it's no beauty and headless besides. Ah, but what it represents, barbarian. Listen, being an outlander, you may not know this, but my son and heir Yezdegerd, even now, is conquering the city-states of our Hyrcanian cousins across the Viliat Sea in name of Yildiz and Turin. One such city he laid waste when it resisted was Makalit.
Makalit?
Of which you doubtless have never heard. Another, as I learned only this dawn, was called Razadan, at least before he burned it to the ground. All that is, save its temple, abandoned by its faithless priests, who made off with everything of value, except this stone idol, which they found in the Holy of Holies.
So, first of all, I find this bit funny, if only because, I mean, I can't help but read anything the king says as some kind of arrogant prick. If I could do like Niles Crane or Fraser Crane, if I could do either one of those voices, I picture actually Niles, because Niles was, Fraser was probably more pompous and boisterous, but Niles, while still pompous, was a bit weaker and more frightened, more of a coward. So I kind of, that's who I feel could do a Yildiz. But through his, I guess, talking down, because you do feel like he's talking down to Conan a bit. But through that, when he mentions Makalit and he makes the comment that, you know, of which you doubtless have never heard, that cracked me up. That was a good little joke, a good little joke there for Roy to put in, because obviously we know, obviously Conan has heard of Makalit. That's where all the shit went down. That's why if Conan was to learn that Yezdegerd heading back to Agrippur, Conan, get the fuck out. Because if you remember, and I'll have the ghost lady, the voice, text-to-speech voice. I got to give her a name. Talk about that later. Help me come up with a name for our ghost lady. But I'll have her come in here in a bit and tell you which issue it is.
The issue that Stephen is referring to is Conan the Barbarian number 20, the Black Hound of Vengeance.
But there's an issue back then, whatever issue our ghost lady told us, Conan gets into it with Yezdegerd. And during the scuffle, Conan slashes Yezdegerd across the face with his sword, leaving a great big scar across the guy's face. Conan escapes, and Yezdegerd is not going to rest until he has Conan's head on a spike.
I'll have your head on a spike!
And so, obviously, Conan knows about the city of Makalit. That's where it happened. That's where his buddy died, Fafnir. That made me really sad, because he was a ginger warrior. Need more ginger warriors in fiction. But I thought that was kind of funny, because he's very arrogant about it. One such city he laid waste when it resisted was Makalit, of which you doubtless have never heard, because you're stupid Sumerian, you're barbarian, you don't know nothing. Conan listens to this little tale, and then he wonders aloud, he asks the king, if the stone statue is a sacred thing, why did the priests leave it? The king, well, he finds the answer pretty simple. When Yezdegerd sacked their town, the priests didn't have an easy way of getting the statue out of the city. It's heavy. They didn't have any way to carry it, and they didn't have time to find anything. They had to get the hell out. And so that's why they left it behind. He then adds a little bit to the end of his explanation. Now, keep in mind that what Conan simply says to King Yildiz is this.
If that thing is sacred, why did the priests leave it?
A simple question, simply answered. The idol was too heavy to carry with Yezdegerd's army knocking at the gates. And do not presume too far, barbarian, on the fact that I value a strong right arm. You'll address me as Blessed of Turin.
Followed by a little snap. You can almost picture a little snap. The king then goes on to explain that Razadan, where the statue came from, it's actually one of two cities, twin cities, and that the rumor is that the head of this statue is in the other city, Demors. I don't know if Roy came up with these names or if he took them from somewhere else, but Razadan and Demors. Yildiz also mentions that Demors just happens to be the city that his son, Prince Yezdegerd, is currently burning to the ground. And so he knows that once the city falls, then somebody's going to ship him that stone head, and he's pretty pumped about that as well. In the meantime, as he's going on and on about this statue, Naram Bey approaches. He's arrived, and he comes up to Lady Amytis. Actually, was he there in the first place? He was probably there the entire time. Yeah, he's there. He was there with him the entire time. I assumed too much. I made an ass out of you and me. Because when the king arrived on the scene in the previous page, he says that he's chosen you, Conan. He's chosen Conan and our just returned hero, Naram Bey, to share the good news with him, and that his lady Amatis is there as well. And I didn't realize that he actually meant that the dude standing right behind him was Naram Bey. Once they got those helmets and crap on and their uniforms, it's really hard to tell a lot of these guys apart. So what I assumed meant that Naram Bey was returning that day, and that with him was coming the statue. He just meant that Naram Bey has already returned. So it's been at least 2 weeks, maybe 2 weeks and a day, who knows? But yeah, Naram Bey's there with him. And so then on page 15, at the bottom of the page, as the king is rambling on and on about the stone statue, Naram Bey comes up behind Amatis and he's like, hey, let's go somewhere else. Come on, we got stuff to do. You and me, we've been apart for a while. Come on. He doesn't care. King doesn't even see us. He's rambling on and on. Him and Conan are just doing their thing. Just come on, let's go. I gotta get some, let's go. And then he says, basically, unless you had other plans, and he kind of looks at Conan with a gleam of suspicion when he says so. Then we go to page 16 and 17. This is a double page spread. It's my favorite part of the issue. It's colored very strange. I keep meaning to pull up the Comixology version of it to see how they, because it's all the colors are changing on Conan a lot throughout this. You know, is his skirt that he wears, his shirt, or his shorts skirt is usually green and it's blue in this panel. And I don't know. I'm not going to dwell on it. But this is my favorite part of the issue, and it's actually my favorite part of the series so far. Because the thing with Conan, what we know about Conan, because we start out, I mean, if you're going to go back and read the Robert E. Howard stories, and you're going to read them in the order in which they were published, then the first one you're going to read is Phoenix on the Sword. And that story is Conan's future. He's already the king of Aquilonia, and he is a very skilled person. He's a barbarian from Sumeria, but he's skilled in tactics and the use of weapons, and he's a beloved king. And so you know, as you start reading other stories that are set earlier in his life, especially ones not long after he left Sumeria, which is kind of where we're at in this series. It's only been a year, maybe two, I don't know, but it hasn't been that long since he left Sumeria. He's still fairly young. But you know that throughout this journey that leads from the day he left Sumeria to the day he becomes the king of Aquilonia, he's going to be picking up all these skills at some point throughout his lifetime. And here is just, I mean, it's a quick drop of information. I think it could have been handled better, but at least it was handled. At least they brought it up at some point. But we get to see Conan here training on the use of other weapons, not just the bow that we saw earlier, but we do see him with the bow. We see him with a spear. We see him working with a horse, like combat from horseback, which, you know, if he's going to be hanging out with the civilized people of the world, if he's going to be involved in their wars, if he's going to serve in their army, he needs to know these skills. He needs to know how to use a bow and arrow, and he needs to know how to fight from the back of a horse, because the cavalry is a big thing. You need to know how to do that. And so we see that. We also see him practicing with something that they call a bolo, which is a weapon that they recently imported from the mystery shrouded lands north of Kitai. But most importantly, we see him practicing with the axe, but he's practicing throwing axes. And so he's got two fairly large throwing axes, but he's throwing one of them and it goes through the center of three different stakes in the ground. It's pretty cool. But it's a good double page spread. And again, I like that even though it's literally just handled with these two pages, and you know, it's like they vomited out into the series. Oh yeah, by the way, Conan does some training and he learns some skills. Here you go. Blah! And they throw it up there. They vomit it out onto the page. But I'm glad that it's finally come up. So this would be the same thing as an 80s montage, 80s training montage. And I'm fairly certain that Roy mentions that this two-page spread is supposed to cover the span of a couple of weeks, maybe even a month. So yeah, Conan comes into this issue knowing some stuff, and he's going to leave the issue a much, much more skilled warrior. I like that kind of stuff.
I like it a lot.
Roy also mentions in his book that this issue was primarily used to kind of place Narum Bay in the spotlight. Narum Bay and Amytus and what he refers to as a courtier by the name of Fayed Ratha. He mentions that all three of them will be important two issues later, and that all three of these characters actually originated from a Robert E. Howard story called The House of Arabu, which he had planned to adapt for issue number 38. And it featured the story, the original story featured a Greek named Pyrrhus, and it was an adventure among the Mesopotamians, which is kind of what we got here with Conan and the Turanians. I'm sure we'll talk more about that when we get to issue 38, probably, I assume. I don't know. We'll see. Go to page 18, and Conan has come to visit the Lady Amytus at her quarters. He stands out in the courtyard underneath her balcony, and he whispers at her, you know, hey, where you at? Let me in. Amytus, let me in. She comes out onto the balcony. She's actually already there. I think she's just chilling. You learn that one of her slave wenches, that's what he calls them this time, one of her slave wenches came to him and told him that she wanted to see him and that he's supposed to meet her in the garden. That's why he's down there. And he's basically like, what's up? She told me to meet you in the garden, not up there. What are you doing up there? Why aren't you down here in the garden? And she starts flirting with him right away. And what she says to him is,
what kiss is worth the having, my lover? It is not worth a little work. I've heard it said that Sumerians are born climbers. Well?
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
Are you looking for a podcast that dives into the very beginnings of the Man of Steel? Then check out the Superman Super Show. My name is Steven, and along with Ed Moore, we're just a couple of guys separated by 1,000 miles of geography who like to read comics. Now, we don't claim to be experts on Superman or the Golden Age of comics, but we're on a mission to read every single Superman story from his earliest adventures, one comic book at a time. And each episode will take you back to the Golden Age, where Superman's journey began. From his first leaps over tall buildings to battling mad scientists and mobsters, we break down every story, sharing our thoughts, insights, and laughs along the way. New episodes drop every 2 weeks. So whether you're a longtime Superman fan or just curious about his roots, we invite you to join us on this incredible journey through comic book history. Find the Superman Super Show wherever you listen to podcasts and start exploring the Golden Age of Superman with us today.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, there are currently 12 million active comic book podcasts clogging up the internet superhighway, and 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, talking to the owners, or really just whomever happens to be minding the store that day. And it's through these conversations that you'll meet some wonderful people and learn how comic shops are run in places like Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. So check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old. Find it now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Mike, and I approve this message.
And now back to Hither Came Conan.
And then we get 5 panels. They're right across the middle of the page. And it's 5 panels of him climbing up the wall. And it's a good 5 panels. Again, I can't keep saying this enough about Buscema. He's so good about taking what really is the mundane. It's just Conan climbing a wall, and he turns it into 4 panels that are not boring to look at. I'll say it that way. But he climbs to her balcony, and he's kind of leery about being there. He's like, yeah, all right, I jumped through your hoops. You wanted me to climb, I climbed. But I'm not stupid. If Narum Bay comes out, you know, it's one thing for us to do the deed when he was gone, when he was out of town, but he's back. He's probably in the next room. I'm not doing this with him nearby, because if he comes in to see us, he's going to kill us both. Actually, he doesn't. He doesn't finish his thought. He just basically says, if Narambe were to find us, because I don't think he's worried about Narambe killing him, because I don't think Narambe could kill him. Now, he could send hundreds of soldiers after Conan and kill him in that fashion. But either way, it's not going to end badly. Either way, Conan's going to kill a bunch of dudes and he's going to run with an army chasing after him, or he's going to end up dead, or he's going to end up in prison without his legs or something for the rest of his life. But Amethyst tells him that he shouldn't worry. She's basically drugged him, and she says that he would sleep through an army of crowing roosters. That's how much she's drugged him. And so he's like, all right, then let's get it on. And so by the end of page 18, they are kissing. Page 22, Conan and Amethyst are chilling. I don't know if they're in post-coital bliss. They don't mention it. I don't care. But they're chilling. They're cuddling. She's telling him some of the news that she's heard recently. And she's telling him that she's heard that the city of Demours has fallen and that some of the troops are coming home to bring the king his prize, which would be the head of the statue. That there's going to be a parade. And Conan asks, what makes you think I care? Why are you telling me? I don't care about any of this. They'll tell me eventually. I'm a soldier. I'll know when I need to know. And she explains to him that she's noticed the look in his eyes, the look on his face whenever anybody mentions the name Yezdegerd. He suddenly gets, well, she puts it as if he's got the look of the wolf at bay in his eyes. Because he, anytime he hears the name, he first of all, he's got to hear, he's got to listen, because it could mean that somebody's saying Yezdegerd's on his way back. He needs to know when Yezdegerd's going to arrive. So she's telling him that basically she's just trying to set his mind at ease. She's letting him know that there's a bunch of soldiers coming, but Yezdegerd's not going to be among them. And that was pretty sweet. She even further explains that she doesn't think Yezdegerd's going to show up in the city for quite a while. She knows, or it's her theory anyway, that because his ambitions in life, he wants to be an emperor. He doesn't want to just be a king. So he's the one that's out making this happen. And she feels because of that, he's not going to return until it's done. This isn't a case where his father's like, go out and conquer all these lands for me. He's doing it so he, when his dad dies, he will be the emperor. And he's going to stay away until he's done. He's got all this power at his back before he comes back. And so as they're discussing this, somebody shouts from down below. It's the Night Watch. They hear people up on the balcony. And for some reason, they shout up. They hear people talking and they shout up that they're the Night Watch and they want them to identify themselves, which I didn't know. Must be illegal in Agrippur to sit on your balcony at night and speak to people who are also sitting on your balcony. But Conan immediately, when they call out, he grabs the roof, the lip of the roof above him, and he flips himself up onto the roof and runs across the rooftops to escape. But if I'm going to sit here and sing the praises of John Buscema every single time I see him do something that is incredibly mundane, that he's turned incredibly cool, I got to point out where it looks like he's screwed the pooch as well. This panel, it's the fifth panel on page 22. The panel of him flipping up onto the roof. He's got both his hands on the lip of the roof. They're between his legs. So he's swinging his legs up to the roof on either side of his arms. And that's not going to work, Conan, because your arms are in your way. Your crotch is going to hit your arms. They're going to stop you from going all the way up to the roof unless you are so super muscular that by the time you swing yourself up to the point that your crotch is about to hit your arms, that you're able to pull yourself up with such might that you leap off the roof high enough that you swing your crotch right through there. You're able to let go of the roof. I just don't see that happening. This is not how you scramble up and leap onto a roof. This is not how you do that. In fact, if you follow my Instagram, when I read this the other day, to get ready for the episode, I always read through the issue first, just read it through, and then I read Roy's chapter, and then I go back at some point, sit down and read through it again as I'm putting the notes together and writing up the synopsis and all that. But when I was reading this, I had to take a screenshot of that image, stick it out on YouTube, and just ask the question, what's Conan doing? Because I don't think even Conan knows what he's doing in that panel. So anyway, the soldiers, the Night Watch, Lady Amethyst leans over the balcony and she's like, "What? Why are you bugging me? I'm on my balcony." And they are very ashamed. The only reason they shouted is because they thought they heard a male's voice up there. And again, that's not a good reason. It could have been Naram Bey. Even if it was a voice of a man that they didn't recognize, it's none of their goddamn business. But they're the Night Watch. I guess they make the rules. This isn't a democracy. It's a monarchy. Maybe the soldiers heard the voice and they thought she might be cheating on Naram Bey. I mean, she was. So technically they're justified, but I don't know. I just think that's weird that they're just suddenly going to identify yourselves. I'm hearing voices from the balcony of someone who lives there. We're not used to hearing people talking from the balcony, and so something must be up. It's weird. It's a weird... It's like this was put in. I don't know. I don't know why this was put in. I don't know if the purpose here is to show we need to throw a little bit of danger at Conan. We need to, Roy needs to the reader to understand that despite the fact that Conan is in considerable danger every time he has one of these dalliances with Amethyst, he's still going to have these dalliances. And here's a time where it almost bit him in the ass. I guess that's what we're trying to see here, but he had to have a reason why Conan takes off. Frankly, I think the best reason would have been Naram Bey waking up and them hearing his voice from inside the house going, "Amethyst, where are you at? I just woke up and I have a headache and I need you to come in and give me some loving," or, whatever. That would have been the perfect excuse for Conan to just bolt like that. But to introduce these Night Watchmen with a flimsy excuse that they have to check out what's going on because they heard voices coming from the balcony, and one of them was a man's voice, that just doesn't make sense to me. Page 23 is the next morning. The parade of soldiers are coming into the city. Yildiz is there with his guardsmen, his royal guardsmen, one of which is Conan, who is now wearing their uniforms, which means he's wearing the big turban and the helmet. And he looks uncomfortable. This is one of those panels that I keep pointing out. John Buscema taking the mundane and making it awesome, because here's a panel of just, it is supposed to be Conan looking uncomfortable in his uniform, and John Buscema, it's perfect. Conan looks uncomfortable in his uniform. He looks like he's trying to loosen his tie, like, this uniform's strangling me. And he's kind of pulling the scarf, the turban thing away from his face. And he looks funny, but the parade of soldiers come in. There are people standing all about to see what's happening. And amongst this parade is a priest from Demurs. What did we say the name of that city was? Demurs. But they eat a lot of s'mores in Demurs. Booyashaka.
Booyashaka!
Anyway, the priest is holding the stone head of the statue. He gives it to the king. The king is like a little kid who's just been given the coolest present in the world. He looks like he's about to jump for joy. Do me a favor. Go out on YouTube and just search for home videos of children becoming overexcited after opening a Christmas present. And that's what Yildiz is doing when he's given this head. He's dancing. He's cradling it. He's holding it to his breast like, "I love it so much." And he immediately wants to put it on the statue. He wants to put the head where it's supposed to go. One of the soldiers comes in to take it from him. Yildiz, who's huffing and puffing, brushes him away, telling him that he can do this. He's perfectly capable. Skip a couple of pages of ads. We're now on page 26. And Yildiz, even though he's doing it himself, he does have two soldiers over there helping him. They're putting the head in place where it's supposed to go, on the neck of the statue. And Yildiz points out that it fits so perfectly that it's almost as if the head wanted to be back where it's supposed to go. And that's when they notice that the crack where the head joins the shoulders and the neck is repairing itself. And then the statue comes to life.
We're all gonna die!
One of the soldiers immediately jumps between the king and the statue. It could be Conan. We don't know. It could be Naram Bey. I just don't know. There's just no way to know, because it's a very far away shot. And he doesn't say, "I, Conan, will rescue you, Majesty," which... writers have been known to do that, and it's a horrible thing to see. Horrible thing to see on the paper. But whoever this is that throws himself between the statue and the king. I'm assuming it's Naram Bey because he shouts out an order to one of the other guardsmen, a guardsman whose name is Velur, V-E-L-U-R-R, Velur, yells out to him to kill the demon thing. Velur draws his scimitar and goes after the thing. And that's when we get a bit of horrifying narration.
Velur of Nahari is a 20-year-old man. He has dedicated his life to the palace guard and hoped to receive a pension when he retired in a few short months.
Yeah, yeah. He's just a few short months from retirement. Yep. You know what that means. We're seeing it here at the end of this page, but you don't have to see it. All you got to do is read the narration. You know what's going to happen. Let's continue.
Now he is but an eggshell to be crushed by a great stone hand. Crushed, discarded, trampled, and then is quickly forgotten.
Pretty brutal. Pretty brutal, Roy. I love it when a writer tries to get you even just the tiniest bit invested in a character that you've never met before. You've just met him for the first time, and they're about to die. I love it. I've done it. I got nothing against it. I'm not trying to say that it's a bad. I love it. I'm not being sarcastic. I love it when a writer tries to make you invested, and some of them succeed. And when the person dies, you actually feel it for a moment. You go, ugh, it's like a punch to the gut. In this case, you kind of know, just because I think if Roy hadn't put in there that he's just a few months away from retirement, I don't think we would have known. Maybe in 73, I don't know, that probably wasn't a thing in 1973. It's totally a thing now. It's a trope that you see all the time, but it probably wasn't as bad of a trope in 1973. So page 26 ends with Velour's violent, brutal death. Page 7.
I believe what Stephen meant to say was page 27. Thank you.
Naram Bey is punched in the mouth, and he is not wearing the same uniform as the rest of them. So I'm going to then have to go back and say that whoever it was that jumped between the king and the statue wasn't Naram Bey because they were wearing a blue uniform. I'm going to go ahead and just say it's Conan. Conan's been known hell in the very first issue. He takes charge when he feels it's necessary to take charge. He's not afraid. He knows what needs to be done. He's a smart guy, and he's not afraid to take charge and get shit done. And that's probably what we were seeing right there. It's just that the image was so small, nobody would have known that it was Conan unless they mentioned it. So it could be Conan, might not be. Anyway, Naram Bey, when we start page 27, the statue thing clocks him in the jaw. Naram Bey must have been twisting or something as the creature lashed out at him because it didn't take his head off. It just knocked him out. But we get one of these wonderful John Buscema panels. It's a great page, but I love these panels of his when there's fighting involved, especially when there's a bunch of people fighting. His art doesn't, well, I don't want to say that because his art is great, but it doesn't reach its pinnacle as far as I'm concerned until he's got a great big bunch of people with swords fighting each other. Because that's where he just shines. And he's always really good about just drawing just shit coming off everything. And I don't know if it's supposed to be the spray of blood or just dirt and shit flying up off the ground, but it's great. And so we have all these soldiers swarming this statue, this living statue. And it's, of course, not affected by them at all. It's just throwing them off. It's wading through them like they're just nothing but tall grass. Conan breaks his sword against the beast. And the thing throws a dead body at Conan, knocking Conan onto the ground. At the bottom of this page, King Yildiz has kind of escaped back into an alley. He's kind of hiding behind a wall. Again, I'm going to say it, folks. It's a wonderful panel because you can see people, bodies just flying out in the background from behind this wall where you don't see the stone creature, but it's obviously still killing and kicking ass. And of course, with these bodies that are flying by, again, there's debris and shit just in the air. And there's just something about that makes those images, makes that action feel more real. I love it. Skip to page 30 because 28 and 29 are pages of ads. And the stone creature has broken through the wall that King Yildiz is hiding behind. And it goes for the king. Conan sees an axe on the ground. He picks it up. His uniform is now in rags. But Conan picks up the axe and he goes to defend his king because now he's working for him. It's got to be his king at this point. But he's very ineffective. He's slashing and hacking at this thing with his axe and it's not doing anything but cracking the blade. But it's as he's fighting this thing, as he's swinging at it and whatnot, He's distracted momentarily. For just a few yards away is that priest from Demur's. And he's got an amulet in his hand. His eyes are squeezed shut. He's closed. His hand is closed over the amulet. He's concentrating on something. And that's when Conan realizes that the priest is controlling this statue monster creature thing. As Conan is realizing this, the stone monster grabs Conan and picks him up over its head. And he is about to use Conan, as the narration puts it, as a living weapon, which he's going to use to bash the king to death. He's going to use Conan to bash the king to death. Page 30 ends with the king, his back against a gate, a fence of some sort, and he is cowering in terror. Conan's hanging there, page 31, and he makes a decision, throws the axe that he's been practicing for months on throwing these axes, throws the axe at the priest. We can see that the axe embeds itself into the priest, but the head of the priest and where the axe is connecting are all off camera. We just see part of the blade and the handle sticking out of the panel where the guy's head is. So we assume that it got him right in the throat. Wherever it hit him, it killed him right away. He's killed instantly. And the stone head all falls from the shoulders of the giant, the stone monster, and the stone monster falls over. Conan falls to the ground. He's exhausted. He's beaten. He's bruised. And at the bottom of page 31, Amytus runs up to see if he's okay.
My baby!
And Conan's response is pretty priceless. This continues in the next panel on page 31, but Amytus runs up to him.
Conan, are you...
I am, if it's alive, you mean. Still, I think perhaps you made a mistake of sorts in not seeing first to the scowling Nerimbe. It's not flowers he looks at us now. Oh.
That's her response. Oh. Yeah. So Nerimbe, who's also wounded, who is now conscious, you know, he was knocked unconscious. He's standing there holding a wounded arm in his hand, scowling at the two of them, wondering, why did my woman just run in here and go straight to him? What is up with that? Yildiz at that moment realizes that he was almost killed, and it freaks him the fuck out. And he decides that he's just going to go back into the castle, and he's just going to stay in there for a while. He's just not going to come out. He immediately just goes sad and emo. He just immediately,
I was nearly killed. I, Yildiz, by something sent to me by my own son and heir.
And that's when he starts wondering, did he do it on purpose? Is my son trying to kill me? And then he immediately just goes into, oh, well, I am so sad. Nobody likes me. And it's here that Nerimbe, after noticing that there's might be a little something-something between his lady friend and Conan, that's when he approaches the king and requests permission to take Conan and use him for a dangerous mission, a mission to the north where the rebellion of hill tribes is spreading. And if you remember, let's go back to issue 32 when Conan goes to see Nerimbe for the first time, and Nerimbe gives him his orders, his mission to go to Wan Tengri and Kitai and spy the place out. I believe he had told Conan that Conan came to his attention because of the captain that Conan served under when they went to stomp out this rebellion of hill tribes. And now it appears that whatever they had done didn't seem to stick, because the rebellion has grown, and Nerimbe seems to be using this as an excuse to send Conan. Not only is it to send Conan away from his lady, but send him into certain death. And Yildiz, being emo baby sad boy, his response is simply,
yes, yes, whatever you wish. As for me, I've thinking to do, much thinking, and I won't be stirring forth so much from this day forward. So do with him as you will.
And that's how the issue ends. We get at the bottom next, the curse of the golden skull. Another great issue. I really enjoyed this one. Conan actually saved the day. He defeated the monster. The monster's not coming back, of course, unless somebody takes the amulet from the priest and learns how to control it, and then somebody else puts the head on the statue. But Conan, unlike the last issue, he saved the day. Technically, he kind of got the girl, too, even though she's somebody else's, and now he's going to have to try to stay alive. He's being put in danger because of her. And then, of course, we get a bit of growth from our character. And that growth, of course, is just the fact that he's now learned to fight with a bunch of different weapons. His skills are growing. And I think that's why I dig this issue probably more than I should, though it was still kind of fun. I question the fact that Conan would stay in Agrippur, considering that the prince wants to kill him. But Roy's leading to something. I know that he's leading to something. I just don't know what it is. He keeps mentioning, you know, he keeps talking about something that he's leading to. And I just don't know what it is. We'll see what happens.
We'll see.
Yeah, we will see.
So yeah, that, folks, is all I have to say about Conan the Barbarian number 36. Beware the Hyrcanians bearing gifts. Or at least that's all I have to say about it now. I often find that sometimes maybe even an hour after I'm done, I'll think of something I should have said. And then I think to myself, all right, I'll just include that in the next episode. And then I never do because I forget about it. But if you have anything that you'd like to add, let me know. There's something about this story that you feel I should have pointed out that I didn't, that I glossed over. Maybe there's something I got wrong. Let me know. The easiest way to do that is by email. The address is feedback@hithercameconan.com. Shoot me a line, and who knows? Maybe I will read it out on a future episode.
Everybody out!
Next time on Hither Came Conan, I'm going to be looking at a Conan issue that I haven't read yet. I mean, I like to try and read the next issue before, you know, before I write up this bit here, because I like to give a bit of a teaser about what's coming up, but nah, I just didn't have time to read it. And yet, I can still provide you with a bit of a teaser because, well, here, let me just read to you once again from Roy's book.
The next issue would be a minor tale, except that it would become the only issue of Conan the Barbarian ever drawn by the artist Neil Adams. And that fact alone would make it memorable.
So yeah, if you've ever wondered what a Neil Adams Conan would look like, come back for our next episode when we look at Conan the Barbarian number 37, The Curse of the Golden Skull. That, of course, is published by Marvel Comics and was published back in January of 1974. The synopsis used in this episode was taken from MarvelFandom.com and then altered, twisted, rewritten, and added to by me. My name is Steven. The information used in this episode comes from Wikipedia, along with Mike's Amazing World of Comics at mikesamazingworld.com and the book Barbarian Life, a literary biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1 by Roy Thomas, which you can get now at sumerianpress.com. And finally, the views and opinions expressed within this episode are mine and mine alone, unless I attributed the view and opinion to somebody else. Otherwise, they're mine, and they do not reflect the official policy or position of Marvel Comics, Roy Thomas, the Howard Estate, Conan, his sword, his steely thews, his many fans and supporters, and especially his god, Krom.
Krom laughs at your four winds.
But hey, one last thing before I let you go. I have a call of action for all of you. If you listen to Hither Came Conan on Apple Podcasts, please, while you're there, leave us a rating. You don't have to write anything. You don't have to leave a review. You're not required anymore to leave a review over there. All you have to do is leave a rating. 1 out of 5 stars, 1 being the worst, 5 being the best. Just tap away. I'm told that it helps. I'm told that if you have, I don't know, over 15, maybe it's 20, but whatever it is, I'm told that once you have a certain number of ratings that are fairly positive, then your podcast starts to show up on lists and things, and more people are exposed to it. More people see it. Hither Came Conan over on Apple Podcasts currently has 13 ratings, averaging 4.5 stars, and I'd like to see that hit 16 by the end of the month. So yeah, any help that you can give me would be great. And hey, if you listen to the show on Spotify, they have a rating system over there as well. We have 28 ratings over there with an average of 4.7 stars. So that's your assignment, folks. If you choose to accept it, you would be doing me a big favor. If you've already done so, if you've already left a rating at either of those places or wherever you listen to podcasts, then you've already done me a big favor, and I thank you. And hey, if you just want to listen to the show and not do any of that other crap, that's cool too. You be you. That's all you can do.
Cuckoo-ga-choo?
Yup. So until next time, folks, keep your swords close by, never stop treading them jeweled thrones, and as always, be nice to each other. Bye!
I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Hither Came Conan. Questions and comments can be directed to feedback@hithercameconan.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Hither Came Conan and every other show under the Stephen or Else Media umbrella early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes or just go to hithercameconan.com to sign up today. Hither Came Conan is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out somanypodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes.
Now we're recording. Now we're cooking with grease. That's gross. And yet, so tasty. Grease is so good. All right, let's try this again. Hello and welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast that's treading the jeweled thrones of Hyboria beneath its sneakered, stupid butt. I'm your host. My name is Steven, and I did not update the intro. I didn't write a new intro. This is last episode's intro. Yeah. Let me just write something up real quick, folks. Settle down. Doot, 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 deep, deep, doodle. Just give me a second. Just give me a second. I'm almost done. All to drop the dangerous truth of Wan Tangri. All to drop the dangerous truth of my stinky feet. Duty, it seems, suit Conan.
Duty.
Duty, it seems, suits Conan. So does royal favor is. See, I usually have time to read this through a couple times before I start to record, but. And even then, I still stumble through a lot of it. So buckle in, folks. Duty. I don't like that word. I don't know why I chose it. Duty. Cause now I'm I'm a kid. Duty. Plucks Cobra. Wrong podcast.
Concubine.
Roy also.
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Enough talk.
Great Crom.